This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. The role of artificial intelligence in medicine continues to expand. Now we've learned that the ability of AI to detect tumor cells could be key to more accurate bone cancer prognoses. This was among the topics of discussion with our medical record panelists when I filled in for Libby on Wednesday. Dr. Jamie Spiegelman is an internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Dr. Fahad Razak is Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre.
We've already talked about some of these kind of reports that are coming out. I think a very interesting one a couple of weeks ago was the one on mammography, where AI can detect early breast cancers, and certainly add to what radiologists can do. And the more you can digitize these kind of parts of medicine where people are visually reviewing images, inevitably, as AI gets more sophisticated, it is going to be at the least an adjunct to our current situation. And the two specialties that are most impacted, I think, at the moment are radiology, reading x-rays. So there's no question AI is going to be part of that in the future. And the other one, and that's what's referred to in this one, is pathology, where pathologists look at a slide and kind of visually make determinations about what's a cancer cell, what's a dead cancer cell. Well, again, you can train AI machines to do that with a lower error rate. And again, there's no question whether they'll replace radiologists and pathologists to some degree, you can discuss, but there's no question that it's going to be an adjunct to having human review of the material. And this is just one of many examples that are starting to come out.
Yes, AI for good, right, instead of for bad. Dr. Razak, so how does this work, AI detecting cancer cells versus the traditional way?
It has proven to be the most promising area of AI deployment within the clinical systems currently. And basically what happens is you have an image file. So imagine a photograph, but extremely high resolution. It could be a CT scan of the chest, that has very detailed information about the structures in the chest, the organs, and the bones. Or it could be a tumor that's been removed from the body, and you're looking at a microscope image of it now under very high resolution to try and see the cells. Now, the reason why AI is so effective in processing this specific kind of medical information is that everything you need to know about that patient is contained within that image. And if you can imagine what a computer can do, it can go pixel by pixel by pixel, looking for patterns and connections between the pixels, the color, the intensity. And it can detect patterns that really, at this point, it's clear that once they are well-trained, they can perform better on average in many circumstances than even a very well-trained radiologist. And so this kind of image processing, whether it's a radiology report, whether it's a pathology slide, that reveals the fact that the AI algorithms can pick up things that are well beyond human capacity to detect.
Dr. Spiegelman, what are your thoughts on the era that we are approaching and the excitement that I'm sure it's creating in the medical community?
The goal of AI or anything that we introduce on top of what we are doing now is to make sure that our healthcare is better, getting better and not worse. So the goal is to make sure that we use it in a way that it improves patient care. And we've started using it in the early stages at our hospital in terms of radiology, for example. Our x-rays are AI generated now, but they have to be confirmed by the radiologist. So for example, if you have air around the lungs, it actually shows that on our AI imaging, and we have to be confirm it. If there's a mass there, it also confirms it. So we have to confirm it with the human touch afterwards as well. So And that's not the only thing we use AI for. And I don't like completely using that word AI because everything computer generated is considered AI. It's a hot word to use right now, but really it's just computer helping humans do things.
Yes.
And what we have too is on our medical system, for example, for we're working up somebody for a cancer or for heart failure or for a stroke, our computer system actually suggests things that we may have missed in terms of management or tests. So it's really integrated already in our system. It's just going to get better, I think, as we use it and adapt to it.
Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Is now the right time to sell your home if you're an empty nester thinking of downsizing? The latest report from the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board says there was enough competition among buyers that the average home price rose moderately from March of last year to March of this year to $1.12 million. But overall sales were down 4.5% year over year. Joining me on Wednesday to discuss, Karen Yolevsky, Chief Operating Officer at Royal LePage Real Estate Services, and Jason Mercer, Chief Market Analyst and Director of the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board.
If you look at what we've seen through the first quarter of 2024, has been a modest improvement, I think, in market conditions in the Greater Toronto area. And certainly if you look forward into the second half of 2024 with the expectation that interest rates are going to trend lower, we should expect to see more competition between buyers, and that'll exert further upward pressure on home prices as we move through the end of this year and even more so into 2025.
What were your thoughts when you got the results from the year-over-year report from March? Surprised that prices are up? Surprised that they're not up a little bit more? What are your thoughts?
No, I mean, when we had done our forecast at the end of last year and beginning of 2024, we had expected to be a bit of a year or two halves where, there'd be a lot of home buyers still on the sidelines during the first 6 months of 2024, just because, the expectation was, interest rates are going to remain elevated and that would still pose a bit of an affordability issue for many of these people. Definitely the expectation is that, we're going to see a stronger second half of the year with tighter market conditions and more of an acceleration in price growth.
Let's go over to Karen Yolevsky with Royal LePage. Karen, what are you seeing in terms of clientele? Who is selling and who is buying?
Well, we have seen a return of both buyers and sellers to the market, a bit of a ramp up, as Jason alluded to, as we moved through the first quarter and we look towards what's going to happen for the remainder of the year. So people are coming off the sidelines. Prices are rising again. So that's giving sellers some more confidence that it may be a good time to sell. And also, if they're looking to move up or move down and they're going to be buying another home, that their timing might be good now because as prices start to accelerate, that next home is also going to see a higher price. Buyers, it's a bit of a split camp right now. You've got buyers that are seeing that prices are starting to rise, that more inventory is coming on the market, and they are getting back into the market had they taken a pause last year. However, we do know a number of buyers, particularly first-time buyers, are still on the sidelines waiting to see lower interest rates before they make a move. Some of that is based on affordability and their ability to qualify for a mortgage at current rates.
Right.
And some of that is simply a wait and see to understand where the market's going to go before they make that move.
Karen, in terms of the clientele, first-time buyers, as you mentioned, how young, how old are they in general? Do you have any clients in their 20s, mostly 30s and 40s? Who can afford these $1.12 million homes?
We do have clients in their 20s. We have clients that are first-time buyers. at all ages. A number of first-time buyers, though, we do know, are receiving financial assistance
right.
in the form of down payment, also sometimes in the form of even the monthly payment from family members. And that number has been rising, particularly when you look at provinces like Ontario and British Columbia, which, not coincidentally, have the highest prices of real estate in the country.
Jason, what are your thoughts on that? The bank of mom and dad, basically. If you're older and you can afford to help out your young adult children, are you seeing a lot of that happening?
We are. I mean, we do polling every year in conjunction with Ipsos. And one of the things we're asking people is, if you're intending on purchasing a home over the next year, A, are you going to be a first-time buyer? And B, you know, what are the sources of your down payment? And what we found is increasingly over the last decade or so, as we've been doing this polling, is that, you know, sources from, you know, family members and friends, that, you know, that share of a down payment, has been increasing, and it makes sense. I mean, I think you're seeing a lot of, you know, parents, for example, who have a lot of equity in their current home, or they have a lot of savings that they built up over time. And they're thinking, you know, I'm going to transfer, that wealth to my children now versus waiting until I pass on at some point in the future.
Jason Mercer, Chief Market Analyst and Director of the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board, and Karen Yolevsky, Chief Operating Officer at Royal LePage Real Estate Services. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, the politics of Justin Trudeau's pre-budget announcements.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Ahead of the April 16th federal budget, the housing and rental pre-announcements from the Trudeau Liberals have been fast and furious. The immediate consequence of these announcements has resulted in some intergovernmental squabbles. Here in Ontario, Premier Doug Ford reiterated he will not be legislating fourplexes, even if that means losing some federal funding. Although he did say he is fine with the idea of municipalities deciding what they want for their own towns and cities. That's where Libby began the discussion with our tune into the town municipal panel. Karen Stintz is the CEO of Variety Village. Alex Blumenstein is co-founder of The Peak. And David Crombie is a former mayor of Toronto, among many other accomplishments.
I try not to pay much attention to what Premier Ford says about housing. He's wrong right from the beginning when he started talking about what his goals were, and none of those goals have been met. This is a person who simply glides along, speaks his mind, moves on, and later on apologizes. So I'm expecting an apology soon.
Alex?
I think the big issue there is that Ford has basically backtracked on this idea of allowing for more growth in Ontario because he thinks the municipalities will push back on it, which is why the money might not make it there. He's basically said, no, we don't want fourplexes. And then his opposition has said, well, we're actually for fourplexes. But I do think that the federal government has shown some willingness to play hardball and say you don't get the money if you don't submit a plan that actually will generate, you know, more density and more housing. So I think that's worthwhile to play that hardball. And if they're not willing to do it, then play politics with it to force those changes through and then give them the money. And then on the second piece, which is like the idea of buying up these units, the government will likely not be able to put in place a good program to do this. And my suggestion is probably also fraught, but I would suggest that the government just own the units themselves, which opens up for a number of other issues. But I think that's a better problem to have for the government to own it than to just give away money to nonprofits to own it.
Karen, I mean, with the proviso that you are running as a conservative, so all of these Trudeau housing measures and him getting into it with some of the premiers, what's your view of that?
I think that what he's responding to is the fact that Pierre Poilievre has successfully made the case
that Trudeau is responsible for the cost of living increases that people are experiencing right now and responsible for the housing shortage. And so that's starting to stick to Trudeau. And so now he has to be seen to be doing something about that. And he's throwing money, making announcements, you know, playing hardball, as it were, to show that he's committed to solving the housing crisis and to fixing affordability. But it's just falling flat because, you know, you've been there 10 years and you're waiting for the year before the election to get all this stuff done. Like, it's just, it just has a credibility issue to it. And that if you were really going to solve these problems and you'd come out with something more thoughtful than just $1.5 billion or $1 billion announcement for nobody can even say what, or a bill of rights for renters when that's not even the federal government's jurisdiction. And so it's just hard to take all this seriously.
And again, as we know, the track record of this government is that you have to elect them two or three more times if you want to actually collect the money they promise.
Right. You know, and the ArriveCan app was in a disaster. The gun registry, $46 million, and there's not one gun collected. Like, it just is on and on and on. It's like, you know, just stop touching stuff, right?
That's a good slogan. David, what do you think? Stop touching? Should they stop touching stuff? You've been a federal cabinet minister.
Yeah. No. It'll always be, fractions and fights over policies, particularly in housing, because all three levels of government have a role, a clear role, that's for sure. And I think that the federal government came to it much later than they should have, and they've got this flurry of announcements that are hard to follow and connect for most people. But interesting enough, I could probably make a comment on what Pierre Poilievre's policy is for affordable housing, but I don't think he has one.
David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto, Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, and Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Just one more sleep until the highly anticipated, uber-hyped total solar eclipse. Much of Ontario is in the path of totality, but a lot will depend on the weather. What do you need to know in advance, and how to tell if your eclipse glasses are the kind that will keep your eyes safe? For the answers, Libby was joined on Thursday by Dr. Philip Hooper, president of the Canadian Ophthalmological Society, and Rupinder Brar, senior teaching professor of physics and astronomy at Ontario Tech University.
Yeah, so having eclipses themselves somewhere on Earth, it's not all that rare. There'll be another total eclipse in a couple of years, I think 2026 August, but having it come to your backyard is incredibly rare. And so this total solar eclipse is going to be moving through southern Ontario. The last time this happened, I think, was about 80 or so years ago, and we're not expecting another one probably the rest of this century. So if you want to witness a total solar eclipse in your own backyard, I highly, highly recommend people try to get out there. As far as the weather goes, it's going to be important. The key is during totality, those few minutes when the moon goes right in front of the sun, and the best possible outcome is that we have clear skies in and around the sun and the moon during that time. If we don't, it's still going to be quite an experience to have nighttime fall in the middle of the day. And so regardless, it's going to be a cool event.
When we have that totality and it's all dark, so there's not really anything to see. Am I wrong?
What happens is that the moon covers what we call the surface of the sun, or the photosphere. That's the really, really bright yellow disk that one would normally see. Also, never ever look at the sun, first of all, without the proper protection. But if one did, they'd see this yellow disk. The moon's going to cover that completely in totality. And then what we get to see is the atmosphere of the sun, the corona of the sun, where the interesting weather happens. And so we get to basically see a face of the sun that we never, ever get to see otherwise. It's going to be very exciting during totality.
Dr. Hooper, I am holding my Eclipse glasses. On the inside, they have that ISO stamp. What else do people need to know to make sure that they have the real thing?
The other things to look for are the manufacturer's label as well. They are required to provide that information on the glasses, just like the ISO information. And typically, there's also a stamp of the lab that certified them and provided that ISO rating. When you look at the glasses themselves, if they're the correct glasses, they'll have a metallic sort of sheen to the front of the lens. And certainly looking through them, you won't be able to see anything at all. If you shine a very, very bright light directly at it, you may see just a little bit of a slight glow, but that's all you should see through the lenses.
You know, some people think that even with the glasses, they're kind of leery about looking right at the sun.
I can understand that, because the consequences of a problem are huge. And I think if people have any doubt about their ability to use the glasses, the fit of the glasses, or the quality of the lenses, my suggestion is to look at the Eclipse indirectly, create a pinhole camera so you're not looking directly at the sun.
And how do you do that?
Basically, you can take a piece of paper, cut a square in it, put some tinfoil over the square, make a tiny hole with a pin in the tinfoil, and use that as a projector to project the image. The image is coming from behind you. You stand with your back to the eclipse, and you use that to project the image onto a white surface or a wall, whatever you you wish to do. But that is certainly safer. There are many places on the internet, NASA, other space agencies all providing information on how to construct such a device.
Dr. Philip Hooper, president of the Canadian Ophthalmological Society, and Rupinder Brar, senior teaching professor of physics and astronomy at Ontario Tech University. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Bill in Scarborough phoned when we talked about the possibility of a so-called rain tax for Toronto homeowners.
This is just another tax grab on the poor homeowner. Years ago, they took our eave troughs, and now we put it out on, all the water goes onto the lawn and then it's soaked into the ground. It doesn't go into the sewers anymore. They nickel and dime us everywhere. I just think it's another tax grab that, you know, that's not going on to our tax bill, but it'll be in there somewhere.
Don in Markham also called on this topic.
So I was a member of Markham Council when we introduced a stormwater management fee, which is, I think, similar to this rain tax that Toronto is considering.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our staff do a study, and the staff said that the cost to calculate the fee would be astronomical.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is actually one of our medical record panelists, Dr. Malcolm Moore, whose reaction to Rudy in Toronto during our segment on colon cancer is priceless.
I'm actually calling for a friend of mine, because this is coincidentally, because she just recently went for a colonoscopy and they couldn't do it because she couldn't digest all the fluid that they had her to drink before that, as they said there was still stuff in her bowels.
Oh, okay.
So I'm wondering if there is a way that she can get a colonoscopy, or there's a clinic that can do it without her having to drink that fluid.
that actually speaks to your first comment, which is that a lot of people do not go through screening for colonoscopy because the prep is honestly a pain in the ass, if you excuse the pun. It's very difficult and uncomfortable. But unless you can clean out the colon, and that's what the preps are forced to do, then if there's still stool in the colon, then the person doing the colonoscopy really can't visualize small cancer. So it's an inevitable part of the colonoscopy sequence and is the reason why people are looking at other ways of screening.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Fight Back Libby, and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.